This is the Beat Your Genes podcast, and my name is Nate G. I created this podcast to bridge together the science of evolutionary psychology and the clinical experience of Dr. Doug Lyle, all so that we can discover what life is all about. In each episode, Dr. Lyle analyzes and explains the psychology behind real-life situations from our listeners on topics like romance, friendship, work, family, health, and many more. We broadcast live every Wednesday at 8:30 p.m. Pacific Standard Time, which means you can call us during the show and ask Dr. Lyle a question. The U.S. number is 657-383-0751, or send in your question through the website www.beatyourgenes.org. All right. Good evening, everybody. Good evening, Dr. Lyle. How are you doing today?
Good, good. How are you doing?
Doing okay. There's very sad news in the last week, and just wanted to send our deepest condolences to the victims of the Las Vegas shooting that happened on Sunday. Pretty terrible tragedy.
Incredible.
Yeah. My heart goes out to everyone affected.
Absolutely. You bet.
Yeah. Any thoughts on – well, we really don't know too much about this guy anyway, so we'll just let them – sort it out.
Yeah, apparently, I just heard today that he had been prescribed anti-anxiety medications earlier in the summer.
Oh.
And which is interesting. And we will, we can't pin anything on that, but it's we would know that psychiatric medications are going to destabilize brains, and so it could be particularly problematic when you have a brain that's already very close to the line on something. So we may learn more about that, or they may hush that up. We'll find out.
Yeah, there's an interesting book I think you recommended to me a while ago called Anatomy of an Epidemic that goes over a lot of this information about what these psychiatric drugs do to the brain.
Yes. Yeah, it's actually, we're not going to make a case about this particular case here. Obviously, this guy had a lot of wires loose, but the psychiatric medications definitely destabilize brains and cause tragic things. It's more likely for tragic things to happen. At least that would appear to be the case, since I believe the research evidence says that suicidal ideation doubles when you put people on antidepressant medication. So I don't think they've tracked real carefully whether suicidal behavior specifically increases. It's hard to pin that for sure, I believe, because you can't get a random assignment to condition on something like that. So, but it would certainly be suspicious that would be the case, given what it is that we do know. So, who knows? Whenever I hear about some tragedy, usually we find out, or often we find out, that the psychiatric medications were not too far away from the scene of the crime. And in this case, I believe that's true, but we'll find out more. Hmm. It's always disturbing to see anything like this, where you sweep around the person's existence for what it is that you know. This guy was a smart guy. He had money, and We may find that autopsy may determine that he had a brain tumor. Who knows? But the fact that his father was a sociopathic kind of a character certainly lets us know that there was a genetic influence involved here. We don't know enough about the other pieces of the puzzle. But I'll be interested to hear what it is that we do learn. Yeah.
All right. Well, with that said, we're going to keep going with some of the questions that we didn't finish last week and continue on. The question we ended with last week was about people who exist that sit in the middle for all five personality traits. So this guy who the shooter was most likely, on a certain outlier in certain part characteristics. But the question we have today is, what do people that sit in the middle for all these five personality traits, like what would it be like to meet such a person? Would they be successful? Would it be alluring? What could you tell us about somebody who's smack in the middle?
They would be very, very unremarkable. In other words, if you notice and you look at these personality traits, they're probably going to have a mate. They're probably going to be successful as far as that goes. Just because they don't have anything that's so disturbing or unusual that puts them as an outlier on some dimension. This is a very unremarkable person. If you look at all six personality variables, the big five plus intelligence, you can see underneath here there is very definitely advantages and disadvantages or preferences that we have for these people on different places. So more intelligent people are more valuable than less intelligent people. In principle, all things being equal, more open people are more valuable than more closed, for the very reason that they have survived more adventures and they have more to tell us, and they probably have learned more about the world than its extremes. And so, if they're still functioning and haven't done brain damage to themselves, then they're interesting. They're much more interesting to talk to than a person who's very closed. When it comes to conscientiousness, obviously a highly conscientious person is more valuable to you than a low conscientious person. An extrovert is more valuable than an introvert, all things being equal. They know more people. They're better connected. A person who's more agreeable is more valuable than a disagreeable person in general under most circumstances. And a more stable person is more valuable than an unstable person in general. So you realize that these things are not value-free. Yet evolution has sort of put these things in bell curves, and there are prices to be paid when you are on the valuable side because people will be attracted to those characteristics and they will potentially exploit them. And they also may serve it as advantages for the holder of those characteristics. However, it's also the case that the people on the other side of the bell curve amazingly are just as adaptive. For various and sundry reasons. Disagreeable people out-negotiate agreeable people. Unstable people invest more energy in low-probability successes than very stable people, and therefore they exploit opportunities that wouldn't otherwise be exploited. The low-conscientious people renege on debts. And essentially wind up also in an exploitative situation relative to conscientious people. So you can see that amazingly, that's why they're in a bell curve. Now, what was the question? What would somebody down the middle look like? Well, they wouldn't be particularly strong in anything, and they wouldn't particularly be weak in anything. So nothing would stand out to you as seeing that this person was particularly valuable. They wouldn't have any significant liabilities. So everything about them, they're like the secretary in your typing pool that is in the middle for speed, and she's in the middle for mistakes. She's in the middle for how many days off she takes for sick days. She's in the middle for physical attractiveness. She's in the middle for how much social sniping goes across her desk and how many complaints she raises. In other words, she's an average employee, and you're not looking to be excited about her to promote her, neither is she going to be kicked out. So that's how I would look at somebody down the middle of the bell curve. Not too interesting. So that's what we would say.
Interesting. Wonder how many people we've met like this, or from what you're saying is we probably wouldn't even remember if we've met people like this.
Yeah, you wouldn't remember them. You wouldn't be like, wow, can't wait to get together with them.
So they're not very polarizing when it comes to
right.
How they right. Okay.
Yeah, they're just a average human with an average coalition with an average life, and they're not going to be generating a lot of feelings one way or the other in anybody. So that's more or less how it is. So their family and their cats and dogs will love them, and that's good.
Fantastic.
All right. Let's go.
All right. Our next question is about braces. Dear Dr. Lyle, I have less than perfect teeth, not extremely unsightly, but bad enough that I dread smiling in photos. I never got dental braces as a child, but now I'm 24 and I'm heavily considering getting them in the next few months. But the idea scares me. Not intimidated by the financial cost or the potential for pain, My concern is purely social. I do work that forces me to speak face-to-face with many people, including strangers, each day. Fortunately, I'm in a happy long-term relationship, so no dating concerns, but I'm still mortified by getting strange looks from everyone I meet for a year or more, so much so that I told myself I would never get braces. But objectively, I feel that getting braces is best for my long-term happiness. I'm having trouble coping with potential embarrassment. What are your thoughts?
Oh, to be 24. Listen, whoever this young person is, get the braces, for goodness sakes. Face it. The truth is you will habituate very quickly to any looks or cross-examination. They'll be minimal. People won't really think hardly about it at all. And I would say, even if you were right in the middle of a mating market and you were trying to score, I would still say get the braces. This is nothing to live with. If this is an embarrassing issue that you can live without, then by all means, pay the price and get it behind you. So no, that's to me, that's a no-brainer. Just face it. It is not. It will not be nearly as bad as you think it is. That's how that works. So just in general, people are – this is to tie this back into evolutionary psychology and esteem dynamics. This is a conscientious individual who is overestimating the worst-case scenario. So they're overestimating the social costs that are going to be involved here, and they're overestimating them by quite a bit. And so therefore the right thing to do is to go against a little Stone Age circuit that's overworking itself and grit your teeth and then find out that it really wasn't any big deal. And then we're going to be really glad when we take those braces off a couple, 3 years from now and you've got, you know, beautiful straight teeth for the rest of your life. Well worth the investment.
Mm-hmm. So I have a little challenge question for you. How is it that you know that this is overestimating the worst case scenario?
That's a very good question. Let me think about that. I would say that I have held people's hands through some pretty extraordinary, potentially embarrassing processes. And I would say that the surprise to me, if there is one, is to find out how self-absorbed everybody else in the world really is. And so we think we're self-absorbed, but everybody else is just as self-absorbed. And so it turns out people don't really care that much about what on earth is going on with you. And so the truth of the matter is, go about your business, and the most exciting thing that you could do to the village would only be news for about 4 days until something else happened. So I've just been through this too much with too many things, like, oh my gosh, you know, I'm deeply religious, I couldn't possibly get a divorce, I'd be drummed out of my church, blah blah blah, and it turns out nothing of the kind happens. It's like, done without screaming and done without fuss. You can do things, and people will just sort of shrug their shoulders. And there may be a few social relationships that are modified or lost, but basically, you can pretty well do just about anything you want. So, this isn't even 1/100th of what it takes to come out as a gay or lesbian person. And yet those people get through that, and most of the time it's enormously liberating, and they wind up, most of the time, at least these days, very successful at achieving what it is that they were hoping to achieve. So anyway, this is a no-brainer. We just face it, and we get through it, and it's not, you know, well worth the trouble.
Mm-hmm. And so on the same theme about overestimating this worst case scenario, how would you go about talking to this particular listener for essentially, I think a couple podcasts back, you mentioned something about worst case scenarios and how you do the down arrow.
Yes.
This seems, I agree with you. That seems like a simplistic example But in general, how would you go about walking through somebody with this, you know, with this type of worst case scenario, overestimation?
Well, it's actually really interesting. It depends on, you know, I'm assuming that I could just bully this person into doing what they should do, which, by the way, I do that fairly often. Yeah. But if it turns out that the person is actually much higher anxiety than a normal individual, and they're actually under great trepidation about something like this, then we find a way to run an experiment. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
So
maybe
I would have them, get a retainer and then wear a retainer around and let's see what happens. And so in this way you can test market some idea and then find out that it's nothing to worry about.
Mm-hmm. Can you tell the listeners the story about the lady who came to you a while ago and said she was depressed, so you had to run a bunch of experiments?
This is a good example of how extraordinary the worst case scenario can stick around in an individual. This is a very old case, so you know usually I'm not telling cases of any detail with anything that happened in the last 10 years. So this is, we're going way back. It's doubtful this person is still alive. In fact, I'd bet almost everything they're not. So this was early in my career, and a woman came to me that to do some weight loss because she was, you know, portly. She wasn't very overweight, but she was overweight. She was 50 pounds overweight like every grandmother you'll see. And she was probably 65, I would say. And so that was 25 years ago. So, you know, this is a long time back. And she kind of sat there. She was very, very introverted. And she sat there for about four or five sessions, you know, basically moping about her weight. And I tried to explain to her a few things and tried to get a little program together. And it was nothing doing. There was no action. And the woman was clearly, to me, quite depressed, and I kept asking her about, that issue and how she felt and what else was going on in her life. And she was very resistant, which I didn't blame her. I'm this young kid, and I'm prying around trying to get her to tell her what's on her mind, et cetera. And, you know, she's coming to me because she knows I'm a health-oriented person to try to get some healthy weight loss. Well, nothing's happening. And so finally, I'm not one to actually sit around week after week or month after month in therapy, take people's time and money and not do anything. I can't stand that. It just goes against my grain. So after probably four or five sessions, I said, well, you know, that's about all I know about this topic. And so, you know, here's the basic plan and so, you know, that's what I can do, and I really don't know anything other way to help you. So, but if anything does come up when you're trying to work on this and you get stuck, then feel free to come back in, and I'd be glad to see you, i.e., I'm not interested in talking to you next week. Okay, so I don't make a follow-up appointment. That's the read between the lines. So she then said, well, there is something I want to talk about. I'm like, oh, that's interesting. And she said, I said, well, what's that? She said, I'm depressed. Of course, and I'm thinking, well, of course you're depressed. It's obvious that that's true. But I'm saying, uh-huh, okay. And what are you depressed about? Well, I'm just depressed. I said, well, you know, how long have you been depressed? And she said, my whole life. Now, I'm paraphrasing now, but this is pretty close. And I said, uh-huh, okay. So your whole life? And she says, yes. And I said, actually, it was a little different. I said, are you depressed all day? When, et cetera? Yes. I said, okay, when you get up in the morning, are you depressed? And she said, no, which is amazing. And I said, really? Okay, when do you start to get depressed? And she said, when I look in the mirror. And I said, what are you thinking when you're looking in the mirror and you're depressed? And she said, I'm ugly. And I said, you know, she was not ugly. She was a very average looking woman. And I said, what makes you think you're ugly? And she said, my rosacea. And so her cheeks were a little bit red, but it was completely within normal limits. There was nothing unusual about this at all. And I said, what makes you think so? Well, I just think so. It looks terrible, etc. And I said, how long have you been thinking this? And she said, my whole life. And I said, really? So when you were 30, this is what you thought? She said, yes. And I said, and when you were 20? And she said, yes. And I said, when you were 10? She said, no. I said, well, what happened between 10 and 20? And she said, well, when I was in high school, I got really bad acne. And I never got a date and never went to the prom and nobody ever wanted to be near me because my acne was terrible. And I said, what happened then? And she said, well, a few years later, it kind of cleared up and then I met my husband and then that's it. And I said, so that's it. That's your last 30, 40 years of your life. That's how that goes. And so you're still thinking that everybody thinks you're ugly. She says, yes. I said, do you have any friends? She says, yeah. And I said, what friends do you have? She goes, well, I play bridge. We play bridge. And I said, so you got a friend at bridge? And she says, yes. And I said, okay, well, what's your friend's name? Well, Mary. And you think that Mary thinks you're ugly? Yes. And I said, I'm telling you right now, Mary doesn't think you're ugly. And neither does anybody else. But my input isn't going to fix this. Because what's happened is that this error, this mistake about what other people are thinking of you has been stuck in your mind for 40 years since high school, 50 years. And I said, we have to get it out of there. But the only way we're going to get it out of there is we got to prove it to you that you're wrong. I said, me telling you isn't going to do it. You're going to have to get evidence. I said, let's talk about when you are, have you ever seen anybody that's really disturbing to look at, like a burn victim? She says, yeah. I said, how do people behave? Well, they take a quick peek at them and they look away. I said, that's right. And then they look back because they're like mortified. So I said, so you would be thinking that people are doing that to you. She said, yeah, I kind of think so. I said, nah, I don't think so. So what you're going to do is you're going to go out when you leave here today is your job is to watch people very closely that you have an interaction with. And then I want you to see if you catch them peeking back at you a little while later. And you're going to start with the secretary at the front desk there in my office. You're going to see whether or not she peeked, has a little funny looking peek. Was she staring at you, staring at your face? Because I guarantee you she's not. But you're going to find out. You're going to tell me. And then I said, you probably think that your face looks, you know, like it's almost dangerous or infectious and that people want to stay away from you because it's weird. She goes, yeah, I kind of think that. I said, uh-huh. So what I want you to do at Bridge is I want you to put your hands, take your hand up to your face and touch your hand to your face and say, Mary, I got to tell you something. And then scoot a little closer to her and then reach over and touch her on the forearm. And if you do that, if she's thinking that you're diseased and weird, she doesn't like you, doesn't like your ugliness, she's going to pull away and she's going to be freaked. But if you do that, we're going to find out if anything happens. So you come back next week and you're going to tell me what happened. She came back the next week and she said, you were right. I got to tell folks out there, any young psychologists out there, I got to tell you, this is a really cool thing. So I said, really? I'm so surprised, you know. I said, so how do you feel? She goes, I'm not depressed. I said, really? Not depressed. She goes, nope. So she told me the story. I had told her intentionally to crowd people a little bit by a couple inches, including her friends, touch her face, touch them, et cetera. Nothing but good feedback. Nothing bad happened at all. So that woman now, yeah, that was gone. That worst case scenario was literally out of her head. She stayed around for a couple, three more sessions to work on the weight. Of course, nothing happened. But she didn't care because she was no longer depressed looking in the mirror. So that's an example of how dynamic the esteem processes are. So that woman was inferring all kinds of things about esteem signals from other people. And it turned out that she was mistaken, And we needed to design an experiment in such a way for her to face firsthand and very clearly, you know, the truth. And so, you know, I knew what the truth was. It was obvious to me. So this is, you know, sometimes it may not be obvious to you. Now, in the case of our person here with the braces, it's obvious to me. So if anything, somebody may think the person's kind of cute. Oh, look at the, yeah, you got some cute braces. They look cute. That's probably the worst thing that is going to happen to this person as a result of putting on braces at 24. All of us have seen people with braces at 45 and 50. In other words, we've seen people in midlife take a deep breath and say, I'm going to put these damn braces on because I always wanted to have my three teeth straightened. And people don't think anything other about it than positive. So this is no issue at all. And if we need to run a little experiment with a little retainer on there to see how it goes, that's what we do. But this is in principle how we do things, is we set up experiments in order to check the worst case scenario, and we set them up as convincing as we possibly can. And in other words, we don't pussyfoot around this thing, and we're not trying to rig it in our own direction. We can, you know, we go right into the heart of the lion. And when the people survive the heart of the lion, they feel tremendously empowered and free. And that's how we do it.
Fantastic. All right, we've got a caller on hold right now, but I want to get to one more question,
okay,
and then we're going to take our callers after that. So, caller, if you can just hold on for a little bit, and then we'll take you after this question.
So,
on the same vein of improving yourself, we had a lot of questions. People emailed me about how to quit alcohol. We're going to read the first question, and just so everybody who emailed me, I got your emails, and this is just, we've got so many that this is the one question we're going to use to answer it. So, Dr. Lai, if you can talk about quitting alcohol. Every time I think I quit, I fall off the wagon, and I wonder if I understood it better, if I would have a better outcome.
Maybe. And I think that a better understanding in people that I've worked with drug and alcohol problems and dietary problems, a better understanding can be extremely useful. And so I'm going to walk you through some of the logic, and then I'm going to send you to a webinar on the McDougall diet webinar series, where I this last month I posted this webinar called The Conditioned Cram, done with Dr. Gustavo Tolosa. And so I took tape people through slides of what I'm now going to tell you. The biggest problem with alcohol or any drug is the fact that you become classically conditioned to it. And so you have two problems that are setting this mess up. Problem number one is that whatever the substance is, what it does is it actually knocks your brain out of homeostasis in a way that is very pleasant, but it is actually disturbing to the neurochemistry. So the brain effectively is aware that it's been assaulted, and what it does is it begins to defend itself. So the first time you catch it by the surprise, but the second time it's not so surprised. And so after you repeatedly use a drug, what will happen is the brain is engineering defenses against this, and which is the reason why people end up having to generally use more and more of the drug, because the defenses wind up essentially neutralizing the drug. Now, that's part one of the problem, and that's sort of interesting, and there's the drugs have an allure to them. If the drugs didn't have any downside, if they weren't damage, then we would say, well, what's the problem? But they do damage. These are things that are causing assaults on the, you know, neurochemistry. And so as a result, the system has to defend itself against these assaults, and it does. Now, for people that tinker around with this stuff, and most people, for example, only 1 out of 20 people appears to have the genes that would ever cause them to have actually a real alcohol problem. So there's going to be a genetic substrate here that's going to make some people much more susceptible than others. But if you are one of those people, and 1 out of 20 is a lot, there's 300 million probably adult Americans. So you know, that's a lot of people. That's 15 million people. we got probably 15 million alcoholics in the United States. It's a lot of people. Now, a lot of suffering going on at all kinds of different levels. Okay, so we have obviously extreme dysfunction, and we have intermediate level dysfunction, but it's a problem. And so, there are multiple problems that can be associated with this. Now, so our problem number one is that it's a highly rewarding dopamine rush, that the system, essentially it is signaling that there's been a big reward that has been gained. It's mimicking rich food and sex is what it's doing. So it feels to the nervous system like it is a win. The problem is, if you happen to have the genes for addiction, we're in trouble. And that's that it's going to be difficult to stop at any sane and reasonable point. And what will happen is that repeated use is going to cause us to start, the brain is going to start figuring out when it's likely to be drinking. So it's going to be looking for all kinds of cues, time of day, location, et cetera. And so even events that take place, like a person always starts drinking after they go play rugby. Okay, so the brain is actually looking for these cues because it's attempting to anticipate when it's going to get assaulted. So it's got to get ready. Now, if it turns out that when you try to stop drinking, you do not drink even though the cues are there, then the brain will engineer its defense, and that defense will be very uncomfortable. And that's that defense, what we call a conditioned compensatory response, that's there to help you. That response will be uncomfortable enough that we actually call it craving. And so then if you drink, you neutralize the craving, i.e. you neutralize the conditioned compensatory response with the drug that it is designed by nature to neutralize. And the two meet in the middle, and you get a neutrality, and through that neutrality, you are in relief. Okay, it's like somebody just shut off a jackhammer that was, at the back of your property. So suddenly there's inner peace. So that's very rewarding and very reinforcing, and so now we're going to do it next time. Now, so that's the basic paradigm of drug addiction and alcohol addiction. Now what we have to understand is the following, that you get conditioned to this, so that means your brain is anticipating this. And if it's anticipating this and then you don't drink, then it's going to be very frustrated and it's going to throw a tantrum. And it's going to try to get that resource. And it's going to be really uncomfortable physically. Depending upon, it might be a little bit uncomfortable or it might be a lot uncomfortable, depending upon the nature of the drug and how much you use. But you're uncomfortable. And if you drink, you're going to be more comfortable because it'll be neutralized. Now, what you have to know is that process of being uncomfortable and frustrated, that process will go away. It will pass. It may pass in an hour. It may pass in 2 hours, but it's going to pass. And then tomorrow, when the same situations come up, it's going to rise again, and then if you don't reinforce it, it will pass. And this process goes through what we call an extinction curve. And the first part of the extinction, the first few days that you don't drink, are the hardest ones because the system is freaking out. It has a big, bad compensatory response that's ready to neutralize a bunch of alcohol. And when there's no alcohol, it feels uncomfortable. So what can you do? Eat, walk, go bowling, get distracted. It'll come in waves, and if you stare it down, it's not going to tear you apart. It's not that bad. All you have to do is get through this. The first day you get through will not be the hardest. The second and third and fourth days will be the hardest because the extinction curve doesn't just go drop off. It actually goes up. It gets more intense before it gets less intense. That's called an extinction burst. So this is like a cat. Think of alcoholism as the neighbor's naughty cat that comes over to your yard, and you don't know it, but it's actually beating up your cats and crapping in your yard. And you don't realize that it is because it's a sweet cat, apparently, and it's cute. And so what happens is you're feeding it. Now it comes to your back sliding door, and you feed it. Okay, and then it comes again, and you don't know that it's doing damage. It's crapping and beating up your cats, but you don't see it. And now he comes again, and you feed it again, and then you feed it again, and then you feed it again. So now you fully condition this animal. So every night at 6 o'clock, it comes by and it's yelling at the door. Now, if you find out that this is not such a good thing and you shouldn't be feeding this cat and it's beating up your cats, so it comes to your back door, if you don't feed it, it's going to raise hell. Okay? And it's going to come the next night and it's going to raise hell the next night. And it's going to come the next night and it's going to raise hell the next night after that. But finally, what will happen inside of that animal brain, it will start to realize it's probably not going to get fed. So it won't come around as much. And then it's going to quiet down, and then pretty soon you won't see it for weeks at a time. Now, every once in a while, that cat is going to stop over there and he's going to meow at your back door. That's called spontaneous recovery. It was noticed by Pavlov more than 100 years ago. Okay, so this is a very clever mechanism built into animal brains that says if you were used to a resource and then suddenly it gets pulled away, fight like hell to get that resource back. That's the extinction burst. And then after you keep getting frustrated, start putting out less energy to try to get the resource. And then finally, don't put out any energy at all to get the resource. That's called extinction. And then once in a while, go back and check and see if you can get the resource. That's spontaneous recovery. Now, you can imagine if that cat comes back 3 months later and scratches at your back door for a little bit, and then you feed it, of course it's coming back the next day. And when it comes back the next day, if you don't feed it, it's going to scream bloody murder, and it's going to be back 3-4 days in a row. So if you use once, you are very likely to use now sometime in the next week. This is what makes alcohol, getting a control of an alcohol problem so slippery. So even if a person grits their teeth and gets through an extinction burst and gets clean for a couple of weeks, and this thing starts to go into extinction and it gets much quieter, they might go 2, 3, 4 months. And then what happens is some little cue comes up. They get a spontaneous recovery, and if they drink, now they're in trouble. Now they've fed the cat, and now the cat's coming back tomorrow, and it's going to be yelling. Okay? The most important thing that I can tell you about fighting any problem like this is not the obvious, which is to, once you get through the extinction burst, never reinforce a spontaneous recovery. That's very, very pleasant armchair psychology to say that. And that's fine. Obviously, that would be the ideal thing. But that's not the most important lesson I have for people. The most important lesson that I have for people is that if you relapse, there is no reason for this relapse to go on and derail your life for the next 5 years. What you have to understand is that right in the early parts of a relapse, the first few days, this is where you need to jump on this thing's neck. You are not fully conditioned again. It isn't as if you've drank 100 times in 100 days and we've got a fully conditioned organism. What we have is you are partially back into the conditioning curve, and if you jump right now on top of it, you will not have to fight a major extinction burst. And so the price that's involved here to get back on track is far lower if we move very, very quickly. Okay? So that's the, you know, take a few days off work, go camping in Tahoe, change something. In other words, change the game very quickly, get, you know, change the pattern, because we need to move now. Now, if we do this, it's useful to think of it this way, very mechanically, and not personally, not about personal failing and all this kind of stuff. Like, forget about it. This is a twin set of learning devices. Number one, the device that says go after things that are highly rewarding, and alcohol, for example, is supernormal stimulus, so it's hitting circuits harder than anything natural except sex. Okay, so it's really nailing a system really hard. And so as a result, the system says this is a great reward. And then second, you're fighting something else, which is a classical conditioned mechanism that gets used to a reward and therefore craves it. Okay? And so it's useful to know that these things are actually a pair of devices that you need to be kind of aware of both of them. And that once you are aware of both of them, this very much depersonalizes this. this gets to be essentially people that work with me on these issues. We talk about these things pretty much like it is. It's not us. It's it. Okay, it's a system we are attempting to neutralize and to outsmart. And when we struggle with it and it outsmarts us, we don't catastrophize over it. We roll up our shirt sleeves and we go back at it. So that's the story of how we work on that problem.
All right. Excellent.
All right.
Okay, caller.
All right. What else do we have?
Caller?
Oh, yeah, go ahead.
What's your name? Where are you calling?
Yeah, this is Naj. I'm in Atlanta. How you guys doing?
Yes.
Naj, welcome to the show.
Oh, thanks for letting me on, man. Interesting conversation here, man. Yeah, I got
cool.
Two questions.
Yeah.
One is really easy for the doctor, I'm sure. And the second one I think will be a little odd, but I wanted to hear what he thought. First one would be, you know, since this is something that you deal with, I don't. So I don't know how far outside I am on this. But as far as Maslow's hierarchy of needs, is that something that's kind of been turned away from and looked at as kind of, you know, old thinking and has been improved upon? Or is that still something that's kind of valuable and kind of worth measuring, you know, in population groups?
I got to tell you, that's a really good question. You have no idea what a beautiful question that is coming from you, because that's actually a significant theme that I'm writing about in my book. And so Maslow was a pioneer in thinking about the upside of human psychology. And so he was along with Carl Rogers. Well, Maslow is probably the most sophisticated humanistic psychologist that there was in the 20th century. And he was very interested in the upside of human happiness and how it would work. And he studied healthy people and he was trying to understand them. And so this guy, you know, this guy, I have a lot of respect for him. Now, his thinking was outside of mainstream science. And so it wasn't like you could really test his ideas. His ideas were very broad. And a lot of his ideas, of course, ring true because he was a very good general observer. There's some aspects to his ideas that are now seen from the vision of evolutionary psychology. They're going to be weak and they're going to be kind of in trouble and they're going to need to be revised. So, but in general, I would say this, that Maslow's vision for really trying to focus on human happiness and how it seems to be attained, and I would say his description of what he called self-actualized people, even though people immediately turned it into this competitive hierarchy about how I'm actualized and you're not, which is always hilarious to watch a bunch of psychologists chase their tails around this one. There was much truth and deep truth in what he was attempting to convey, which is that people that had mastered a lot of the problems of life were more focused on essentially their self-esteem and being proud of themselves for doing things to the best of their ability, and they had a resilience about whether or not that best was good enough for anybody else, if anybody else would like it or not. In other words, you know what? I'm going to try to learn how to be a painter, and if nobody likes my painting, I can live with that. But I'm going to try to learn how to be the best painter I can be, and that's that. So that sort of resilience and that sort of focus on personal essentially the internal audience's judgment of one's efforts is the way that I would put it, is something that Maslow was sensing and attempting to describe when he was describing really the happiest people that he could see. So, not deeply respected by science because the ideas were too general, but respected by everybody, I think, in his attempt to look at sweeping motivational problems that aren't narrow, and we're not talking about rats in a lab, and we're not talking about conditioning of alcohol. We're talking about something much more broad about how people approach their lives and the goals that they approach. So Abe Maslow had much interesting to say.
Okay, thanks a lot. And the second question is a little more clumsy and a little more difficult.
Yeah.
But I feel like this is one, you know, I don't think people have tackled. But I listened to you speak, and you were talking about the test with the lady with touching her face, which sounded amazing as a way of, you know, overcoming something. So I wanted to ask, do you have in mind, do you think you could come up with a test for black people to actually figure out racism in the workplace and figure out, hey, maybe I'm paranoid in this particular situation. That person is not even racist. That was my own, paranoia speaking. Is there a way, do you think there's a test that could, you know, help in that aspect?
Boy, that's a good question. And being a white psychologist in white areas, I've rarely dealt with people of color of any other race. And so this is just not a problem that I've ever had to think about. I can actually remember a couple of cases early when I was at the University of Virginia. I had a young black man who was clearly frustrated with some racism he was feeling on campus. And, you know, I'm a young student, and I'm kind of lost. I didn't know how to help him, and I certainly could understand where he was coming from. The Charlottesville, Virginia, of course, of all places. So your question is fabulous, and I have I'm wondering if there's other psychologists that have looked into this. There's been some really outstanding thinking in these areas of stereotypes and the damaging of stereotypes. Claude Steele was a pioneer in this area and some research that he has done. It's there. You know, there is prejudice. There are problems. And sometimes they're very quiet. And so it's you've got a great question there. It's like you're not paranoid if it's true. You know, that's the old joke. You're not paranoid if they really are out to get you. So I think that problem is probably so subtle, and people with any kind of ability in life can be so careful about their behavior and treat people superficially well that they can cloak these issues so well that really, for all intents and purposes, they're not there until the rubber may hit the road on some very important decisions. Okay? So that's a little bit I'm sure that there are tests that we could devise, and we could probably come up with something. But I would say this, that in a lot of cases that I have seen in the workforces that I've been in, I've been in a lot of different kinds of jobs over the years, that I do see people, you know, often naturally segregate. In other words, as much as we would like to think that things are fine, things can work fine, but there tends to be sort of a lot of natural segregation that takes place, and people seem to know that they kind of have to live with it a little bit. And so I would say that if you're in a situation where you're in a job where it feels like the deck is stacked against you, there's a good chance it might be, and we might need to find a place where that hierarchy doesn't look like it would be. So that's the advice I would give to someone, a person of color with ambition, that was feeling like the deck might be stacked against them. And I would say, do your best and see what happens. And if it looks like it's not fair, maybe it's not. and we may need to look hard at another hierarchy to go to if we feel like it is. So anyway,
okay.
I don't know what else to tell you.
Well, thanks for your answer, man. I'm going to look up Claude Steele and try to see what information they have. But, you know, more than anything, I was just trying to figure out who to avoid and seeing, you know, just making sure that I'm correct in my assessment and not just being paranoid and assuming something. So, thanks for your answer, man. I appreciate the honesty. And, you know, it was worth the shot after that brilliant facial test you talked about. So it was worth the shot.
Okay.
Y'all have a good night.
All right. Very good. Thank you.
Nas, really great questions. Really appreciate you calling in. Thank you very much, and have a wonderful night. Thank you for listening. All right,
man,
we have another caller.
That's a tough question.
That is a really tough question.
Yeah, go ahead. Let's get another
one. Really, all right, we have another caller calling in.
Okay.
All right, caller, what's your name? Where are you calling from?
Hi, this is AJ from Sherman Oaks.
AJ.
Yeah, this one won't be tough.
Well, it's about sex, because I've always wanted to ask you this, but whenever you're speaking on nutrition, it doesn't seem appropriate. So my question is specifically about pornography and prostitution.
Yeah.
When did they become a thing?
For them both.
Well, but, okay, I believe that you're...
All right, now go ahead. Don't back up, AJ. I'm just pulling your chain. Go ahead.
But seriously, like, I can't imagine people engaging in either in the Stone Age... And because they don't perpetuate our genes, so what is the purpose of prostitution and pornography? And when in the timeline of human history did people start paying for sex and paying to watch people have sex? Because I don't really get either of them, to be honest.
Okay. Both of these things have their roots in the male casual mating strategy. So AJ being a chick... You know what I mean? Isn't going to have a lot of insight into this. Okay. So that's where the problem starts with your ability to understand. So so what's going on here is that the male brain is vastly more predisposed to casual mating strategy than the female brain. We can't get wires crossed and a guy being a very monogamous pair bonder, not interested in any variety and never would be interested in porn. Is that possible? Yes. Okay. So that guy exists as well does the wildest chick that you've ever seen. So both of those exist, but as population distributions, if we were to look at behavior, we're going to see overwhelmingly that the female mind is much tamer than the male mind when it comes to novelty and variety and the motivation for that. And so what pornography is pornography is a supernormal stimulus that is basically is telling the male brain through essentially through the magic of video and vicarious experience, because we've got mirror neurons, and therefore when we watch people on a screen, we can put ourselves in their place. What can happen is, you know, that's the only reason movies work, is that we're watching people and we can imagine their emotions because we can see their facial expressions and what the drama of the situation is. So we can essentially experience something of what they're experiencing. And so in this way, pornography puts men in a situation where very attractive females are interested in casual relationships, and there is nothing about this story that indicates that this is a pair bond. And so and it all happens, you know, they meet at the first 37 seconds of the video, and 2.5 minutes later, they're already got their clothes off and they're having sex of some kind. So this is, in the male brain, this is like kind of as good as it gets. Okay, so that's what you're seeing there with pornography. Prostitution is, again, there's various angles to this, but this is a situation, a classic situation is a 5 gets a 10, okay, in principle. So a male can even the score between the differences of the sexual attractiveness between two people by making it economically lucrative for a female to do this. Now, this is nothing other than a a projection or an extrapolation of the very basic trade that takes place with females and males generally. So the general trade between males and females is that the male will give that female, he will sleep up, the 7 male gets an 8 female who trades down in human mating, only because this is a pair bond situation where she's going to get a tremendous amount of resources from him. Okay, so if you think about it mathematically and the way the genes would have shaped these brains over evolutionary time, is that the female is attempting to optimize the amount of resources she gets per sex act, and the male is attempting to minimize the amount of resources that he gives her per sex act. Okay, and so the two of them are diametrically opposed to each other in terms of their motivations. And then we're going to throw a third variable into the problem, and that variable is the gene quality of the individuals that it's involved, i.e. their sexual attractiveness. So when we throw this into the mix, what we're going to get is males attempting – now, you might say, well, sometimes males sleep down with prostitution, but that's also because they are – the female is within their threshold for willing to be sexual with the female, but they're attempting to minimize the total cost. In other words, there's no implication that there's going to be any long-term investment in the female. So this is essentially the male brain saying, I want to take one shot at getting you pregnant, then I want to get the hell out of here. And if I'm successful, which incidentally, in the Stone Age, the success of unprotected sex between fertile people is 5% per copulation. That is very high, okay, when you really think about it. So that means that the female is going to do, if you think of all the work that it takes to raise a child, divide all that work by 20. And that the sum total of those hours of effort, that is what a sex act costs a female human. That is phenomenally costly. So you would expect that human females would be damn choosy about their mates, trying to get not only resources from males, but the best genes they could get. Now, if they are going to relax the gene quality and they're not going to get long-term resources, there's only one trick left. And that is to get as much short-term resources as you can get. So prostitution is going to be about, you know, females today that do this are, you know, there's a lot of reasons why they're desperate, they're drug addicted, but not everybody. Sometimes they're being very, very careful with what it is that they're doing, and they're trying to exercise as much mate choice as possible while they extract as much money as they can possibly get their hands on per sex act. So this is nothing other than the very same calculus that women have been doing since the dawn of time. We're just moving the parameters over a little bit. This is the famous, I forget who it was. It was probably, it wasn't Oscar Wilde because he was gay, but I can't remember who. I don't think it was Winston Churchill, but the famous
Coolidge.
The famous joke between, it's not Coolidge. Oh. Some famous discussion between some fancy Englishman and some woman at a party, and she says, and he says, well, would you sleep with me for, you know, £1 million? And she says, you know, no, would you sleep for me for £10? And she says, no. And he says, would you sleep with me for £1 million? She says, yes. Or then he says, £10. And she says, well, what do you think I am? And he says, well, we've already established what you are. Now we're just bickering over the price. Okay. And so that's in principle all it is that we're looking at, is we're just moving around all the parameters that are in play. And one of the things that comes out of that is prostitution. Another thing that comes out of that is sugar baby, sugar daddy relationships. So that's another variant of this same thing, that where the females are exercising considerably more choice than they would exercise under prostitution. And so therefore they're not going down as far in gene quality, and they're trying to get as many resources as they can per copulation. And we're not quite as disgusted about that as we are about prostitution, because prostitution seems like an incredible sort of bizarre thing to do for a lot of us, not for all of us. So at any rate, that's how it works.
Wow, but we would have had to have money for the, right? Money had to have existed in the timeline of human history first, right?
No.
Could have been coconuts.
You could have been meat for sex, coconuts, okay?
Wow.
Anything that females would have valued, protection. In other words, females absolutely would have been willing to trade their sexuality for any resource that it would have been in the game. So it didn't start 10,000 years ago. It started a long time before that.
Wow. I knew you'd be able to explain it. Thanks, Dr. Lyle. There's nothing you can't answer.
sometimes there is. All right.
All right. Thanks, Chef AJ. Really appreciate your call.
Of course.
All right.
You know,
Dr.
Lyle, speaking about sugar daddy, sugar baby relationships, I always prefer the diabetic daddy where it's like a sugar daddy, but it's sugar free. Yeah, so.
All right. Well, but that took us a lot of time.
Yeah.
So
we will end the show.
Maybe we stop there.
Yep. We'll go over the rest of the questions next week. All right, Dr. Lyle, thanks very much.
Really
appreciate it.
Thanks for listening. If you like what you hear, subscribe, write us a review, or share this podcast with a friend. To send in a question or read more about the show, you can visit our website at www.beatyourgenes.org. Until next time, this is Nate G. and Dr. Lyle with Beat Your Genes, an evolutionary psychology podcast for finding happiness in the modern world.